Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I am Joe McCormick, and it's Saturday. It is time to go into the vault for an older episode of the show. This one originally published November 1st, 2022. And Rob, this is an interview you did with the author Brian Hoggard.
Yes, yes. This is the author of Magical House Protection, The Archaeology of Counter Witchcraft. Just a really fun, fascinating discussion about the various curios that have been unearthed in old buildings throughout Europe and also in North America, where things have been hidden in walls or under floors that have some purpose of protecting the house or the inhabitants from evil spirits. So this is a great one to listen to for the first time or re-listen to as we begin to get into the Halloween season.
Let's jump right in.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb. My regular co-host Joe is out on parental leave, but today I'm going to be chatting with independent researcher into the archaeology of folk magic, Brian Hoggard. He's the author of the excellent book Magical House Protection, The Archaeology of Counter Witchcraft, which I highly recommend. So without further ado, let's jump right into the interview. Hi, Brian. Thanks for coming on the show.
Hi, you're welcome.
So much of your work, and certainly your 2019 book, Magical House Protections, revolves around the archaeology of counter-witchcraft artifacts secreted, in many cases, within historic homes. So before we get into the varieties and the particulars, what parts of the world and what time periods are we predominantly dealing with here?
Well, it's actually worldwide, and I think it's been going on forever, to be honest with you, because humans seem to innately believe in the power of some kind of supernatural evil, and they fear it wherever they exist, whether it's sort of tribal societies or up to sort of quite sophisticated societies. And so it's been happening for as long as humans have been around, I think.
Now, I want to come back to specifics in detail later, but what sorts of objects are we talking about, and where do we tend to find them positioned in a home?
Okay, so I normally work with Western Europe, but also receive reports of objects from much further afield as well. And, you know, within the home, we're talking mainly about hearths and thresholds. So wherever there's a fireplace or a chimney, that tends to be the main point of focus for a lot of these objects and practices. And that's because the chimney is always open to the sky, because it kind of has to be. And so it's also the most vulnerable point in the building for that reason. So at night, people fear things coming down the chimney. and also thresholds, so windows and doors, obviously, are also points where the house could kind of leak, essentially, and they would often be protected. And literally any boundary point within a house, any precious object or precious person or precious artifact can, you know, you can find that people have gone to some efforts to protect them.
I hadn't connected the dots on this till just now, but mentioning the hearth as being an entry point, I guess we see this reflected at least distantly in traditions of Santa Claus entering a home through the hearth.
Absolutely. Indeed, that goes even further than that, really, because it is the idea of some energy coming down the chimney. But one of the types of objects that we often find in homes is concealed shoes. And obviously, at Christmas, you hang your stocking by the mantelpiece, which is a similar kind of thing. So you're kind of trying to trap some good energy instead of some bad energy.
Oh, wow. Now, early in the book, you do a tremendous and seasonally appropriate, I think, job of describing what the experience of church may have been like, especially to a pre-Reformation English commoner. It sounds incredibly spooky and really not at all that comforting. I was wondering if you might sort of summarize just a little bit of the energy here.
Yeah, so when in the medieval Britain, when churches were still essentially Catholic before the Protestant Reformation, church rituals were usually conducted in Latin. So most commoners or most parishioners wouldn't necessarily understand the language that was being spoken. And in fact, it's quite widely attested that a lot of priests didn't understand the words of the Latin rituals either. And they learned a lot of them by rote. So they just they knew the sounds. They knew how to emulate a Latin ritual rather than perform one. And those rituals would take place behind a screen, which was called the rood screen, which is basically a wooden screen that's been pierced in a decorative manner. So you could see through it, but not really clearly, a little bit gauzy. And there would also be incense being burned as well, and candlelight. So you've got a sort of spooky language that you don't understand, Latin, conducted in a kind of foggy, candlelit, misty environment, which is quite spooky, as you say. And on top of the rood screen, which was called a rood screen because it would have the rood on top of it, which is the image of Christ at Judgment Day, quite foreboding. And of course, a medieval church would often be decorated with art, sometimes relating to the devil, sometimes relating to saints. So there'd be all kinds of supernatural imagery all around you, as well as the candlelight, the incense, the slightly opaque view of the ritual. It's really quite a magical environment, and I think that's how a lot of people felt about it.
Yeah, you mentioned in this section that, for instance, one might not have like a clear idea of how the figure of Jesus factors into everything, which of course is very easy to take for granted today, especially with among modern Christians and people in Western society. But it's the idea here that you would have sort of the vague structure of the Christian religion, and then just the common individual is then having to sort of fill in the gaps with other supernatural ideas?
Yeah, to an extent. I think it would vary quite a lot depending on how literate someone was or wasn't, and how inquiring their mind was as to whether they were actually asking their priest the answers to any of these questions or not. But yeah, I think this sort of overarching feeling that a God exists, and they would hear about Jesus and they would hear about Mary, etc., but they wouldn't necessarily know what their relationship was. So I'm sure I've read an account before where someone was asked, you know, do you know who God and Jesus are? And they would think that, oh, isn't Jesus God's uncle? And they would be really unclear about the familial relationships that we might now think exist between them.
So how does the Reformation change this scenario?
Well, technically, it's the Reformations, because there was like several attempts to kind of move it along. Essentially, it was about trying to dispel some of the superstitions that might have aggregated around belief in God and Jesus over the years. I think there was about 1,000 years worth of people sort of augmenting what was going on in churches with their own ideas. And the Reformations were supposed to be about stripping all that away and getting back to the actual text of the Bible. Particularly the New Testament, not the Old Testament, and trying to worship Jesus principally, and also God, but you know, with the whole Trinity, the Holy Ghost, then pretty much getting rid of Mary and getting rid of all the saints and all these other things that have kind of grown in importance over the 1,000 or so years before.
So how does the period of witchcraft persecution factor into all of this? Because I'm to understand much of this takes place in post-medieval times, no matter how much we might want to shove it back into prior centuries.
Yeah, that's an interesting one, because I think that belief in witchcraft and beliefs about witchcraft actually didn't really change very much during the period of witchcraft persecution. There were some new ones brought in, but essentially the core beliefs about witchcraft were essentially the same, in my opinion. They just became magnified, and that was partly through the popularity of new pamphlets and literature and the printing press, you know, the advent of the printing press, and partly through, I guess, in a way, I think the stripping away of some of the superstitious aspects or the saintly aspects as well, you know, where you could appeal for help to particular saints, you know, all of that being stripped away post-Reformation, I think meant that people had a bit more of a need to address supernatural feelings in their lives, almost. Okay. And I think it's possible that witchcraft beliefs and worry about it were almost, they sort of came into the vacuum, if you like, created by the absence of a lot of the things that people used to do pre-Reformation. That's a fairly contentious argument. It's not that simple. You know, it's mm-hmm. probably more to do with the printing press than anything else. The fact that sort of very salacious and exciting stories about witches and devils were being circulated in pamphlet form. And then literate people who could read, would then, you know, regurgitate these to people who couldn't. And this kind of heightened awareness of the fact that there could be more danger around than there was before concerning witchcraft.
So you discuss some of this in the book as being like the elite understanding of witchcraft and I guess ultimately demonology, right? That's again, coming down through printed material. And then is it kind of like bumping heads and then meshing with ideas that would have been more commonly held among more common and less literate people?
Yeah, it's kind of we get this kind of very much history gives us more of a top-down look at what went on, whereas archaeology tends us to give us a bottom-up more kind of look at what went on. And really, other than Ralph Merrifield before me and some of his colleagues who've been doing work but not published, there wasn't really an awful lot of people looking at witchcraft from the archaeology angle. So all we've ever seen really is from the history side, top down. And I think an awful lot has been neglected or missed for that reason. And so, you know, these ideas, like for example, I'll talk about concealed shoes again. Some of our earliest examples of that are from the 14th century. But we've also got examples of it from the 1970s, you know.
Oh, wow.
And so so it's been a complete continuum. You know, the period of the witch trials, as people think of it, came and went. But this practice has steadily been carrying on the whole time. You know, you can say that it had a period of magnification during the witch trials. Yeah, but it hasn't gone away and it didn't leave, you know. And it's always been there. So the common people, if you like, the sort of illiterate people maybe, continue doing what they were doing. And then they started to hear about these apparently new dangers or more powerful witches, or that there was some kind of panic going on. And it just raised everybody's fears. So there was always some fear, you know, there was general fear of the dark, general fear of the supernatural, especially particularly around sleep, you know, because how could you protect your house when you're asleep? So that's one of the big worries that people had. But you know, during the period of some people call it the witch craze. I don't really like that term, but you know, the kind of excitement about witches. Obviously, fear was heightened, so people did more things to try and keep them away. And that's when, you know, for example, witch bottles were in my opinion, a direct response to the witch trials, to the period of heightened fear. But the rest, all the other things, seem to have just become magnified, if you like, more important during that time. But they'd always been there.
Now you've mentioned witch bottles, so this might be a good time to ask, what is a witch bottle? What would it contain, and where were they found?
Okay, so witch bottles were, there's an awful lot of detail here. They were essentially German stoneware bottles, which in Germany were known as Bartmann stoneware, nothing to do with the Simpsons. And basically, Germans had this the ability to make stoneware, which is this non-porous, really hard bottle, which in Britain we couldn't make. We only had earthenware. So basically, when we found out about stoneware, we wanted these bottles. Yeah. And so they were shipped over by hundreds of thousands, usually filled with beer or wine. And that beer or wine would be consumed, then the bottle would either be cast away. But the thing is, because these bottles were so good, they'd often be reused again and again and again. But the significant thing about them is that they have a really evil-looking mask of a man on it. Yeah, so they look quite anthropomorphic. So these bottles have a salt glaze, which gives them a kind of leathery, skin-like appearance. Then they have this beastly-looking face on the neck. And then they have a big round belly, which often has a kind of armorial shield on it, which sometimes looks a little bit occult or a little bit kind of spooky. And sometimes as well, they're quite sort of petal-like, quite flower-like, which is which resembles another one of the marks that often crop up in this area of study as well. And so for that reason, you know, if you were going to do anything magical, you would want to use this bottle because it looks anthropomorphic. It's quite a spooky looking bottle. You couldn't imagine a better bottle for doing magic with, put it that way. If you were sitting at home and you wanted to do some. So anyway, these bottles, we quite often find them underneath the floor, sometimes up to a meter deep underneath a flagstone in front of a hearth or directly underneath a hearth, sometimes integrated into an ingle nook into the wall. And, they're often upside down in the ground. We're not entirely sure why the upside down thing happens. But inside the bottles, this is when we x-ray them, they often show evidence of lots of pins and nails that have accreted or aggregated and coagulated around the neck, where the gravity is just taking them down towards the neck. And then when we open them and have a look inside, they've often got some liquid, a big lock of hair, sometimes some thorns or other pins. Importantly, the pins and nails which are found inside are usually deliberately bent as well. And when I say deliberately, we have assessed the angle of the bend, and it seems like in many cases these nails and pins have all been bent around the same iron pole, so someone's deliberately sat there and gone round lots of pins and nails before adding them into the bottle. So there's clearly an element of sort of ritual, or like quite a lot of effort goes into putting it together. And then of course you have to dig this really deep hole to put it down there. And so essentially what we've got is an anthropomorphic bottle, so it looks like a human, and inside it we have the liquid, it turns out, through analysis, is human urine. And so we've got a human's urine in there. We often also have nail clippings, nail parings in there, a big lock of hair, and then all these pins and nails that have been deliberately and meticulously bent before being added into the bottle, which has then been sealed with a bung or a cork, and then buried upside down under the earth, covered over, and a big flagstone put on top of it. Whew. So it's quite a lot of effort, isn't it? Quite a lot of effort.
Yes.
Right. And what I think is happening here is that because 50% of all of these bottles are found by the hearth or in the immediate vicinity of the hearth, so that we've got this focus on the hearth. And so the idea is if something bad, like a spell or an energy or maybe a demon or something like that, is potentially traveling down your chimney trying to attack you, it's plunging down the chimney trying to find you. It detects this human-like figure that smells like you. It's got your hair in it. It's got your fingernail clippings in it. It's got your urine in it. And it dives down to attack you. And when it gets inside the bottle, it then gets impaled on all these dead pins, which you've deliberately killed one by one before putting them into the bottle. So there's kind of like the ghosts of pins there to work against the ghost that's trying to attack you. And so there are some bits of folklore that suggest that spirits and witches aren't very good at travelling backwards. So once they get into a spot, they find it difficult to get out. So maybe there's an element of that, like a kind of trap as well. So like a trap slash impaling people, you know, a decoy that has a trap within it. That seems to be what's going on. But confusingly, there are some texts that relate, that talk about witch bottles, that describe something different, right? So there are several texts in the late 17th century that talk about this idea of boiling a witch bottle. That if you think you've been bewitched, or if you know someone who's been bewitched, you can take a bottle and you can get them to urinate into it, and you can add some pins and nails to it and boil it on a fire. You've got to bung it up and then boil it on a fire. And the idea is that the bottle will act as kind of a substitute bladder for the, you know, and by boiling it, you're causing pain to the witch. because they had this belief that if you've been bewitched, there's something of the essence of the witch inside you as well. So if you then urinate into this bottle and do something to it, it's going to have an effect on the witch. And so the thinking is in these texts that excruciating pain is caused to the witch, who will then come seeking you out and will come knocking on your door begging for you to stop boiling the bottle. And in return, you can barter your freedom from the whatever spell has been put on you. And generally speaking, it says that if that fails, you should then bury the bottle. So that's interesting, but it's different to what we find in the buried bottles. Okay, so the buried bottles obviously have hair, which isn't mentioned in any of these texts. The texts also don't mention bending the pins to kill them, if you like. You know, so what we've got is two separate ways of working that are thought to be behind these two practices. The boiling thing seems to be depending on the idea that you can cause pain to the witch's bladder by sort of acting upon a substance that might be infused partly with the witch. Whereas the ones that are buried seem to be acting as a decoy and a trap. Yeah, and I think that that practice, the one where the bottles are buried, actually resembles and has a lot in common with other practices like shoes and like some of the marks and all sorts. Whereas the one with the boiling seems to be, well, one of my friends who was studying that, called Dr. Annie Thwaite, she was studying it for a long time and she called it the urinary experiment and saw it as a kind of pseudo-medical practice that people at the time thought that supernatural energies were real and that this was a way of potentially removing them from someone. You know, they were sort of using medical theory, if you like, to try and remove the presence of a witch. Whereas the one where you bury them seems to have more in common with folk practices that have been going on for a very long time. So I'm not sure, you know, they certainly both use the same type of bottle. They both emerge at about the same time, which is the third quarter of the 17th century or thereabouts. But two separate practices. And I wonder if, you know, you have the written one that's more about medicine and science, and you have the other one, the buried one, that's like more going with the real old school kind of folk magic to how to get rid of a witch.
Wow. Yeah, it's just so amazing. And so like very roughly speaking, like what sort of numbers are we talking about in terms of surviving witch bottles that have been recovered?
Since I last started counting, I mean, I think when I published, there was about 130 odd Bellarmines, which is the German type ones. And there was probably another 80 or 90 of glass ones that I had on file. And I wouldn't be surprised if the German stoneware ones was easily in excess of 200 by now with the amount of reports. But you have to bear in mind that these things are only ever found when someone demolishes an old building or excavates under an old building. So there's probably a vast amount more that have been discovered that just weren't reported, because these bottles are actually quite valuable. So, you know, you can sell one that wasn't used as a witch bottle for potentially £400 to £500 on eBay. And if it was used as a witch bottle, I've seen people selling them for up to £1,500. So, you know, so yeah, they're reasonably valuable when it comes to the black market. So I think a lot of builders and homeowners, when they find these, they're curious, but they also see an opportunity for making a bit of money. And so we don't know exactly how many there were, but I wouldn't be surprised if they were maybe 50 times more common than my figures suggest. No, maybe even more than that, yeah.
Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product and yeah, it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astapro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astapro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astapro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astapro. Go to astaproallergy.com for a discount so you can get Astapro and go today. Astepro allergy.com. Astapro and Go. Uses directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
A new season of Bridgerton is here. And with it, a new season of Bridgerton, the official podcast. I'm your host, Gabrielle Collins, and this season, we are bringing fans even deeper into the ton. Colin Bridgerton has returned from his travels abroad. Is betrothal written in the stars for the eligible bachelor? Meanwhile, the ton is reverberating with speculation of who holds Lady Whistledown's pen. We're discussing it all. I sit down with Nicola Coughlin, Luke Newton, Shonda Rhimes, and more to offer an exclusive peek behind the scenes of each episode of the new season. Watch season 3 of the Shondaland series on Netflix. Then, fall in love all over again by listening to Bridgerton, the official podcast, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Subscribe to catch a new episode every Thursday.
Now, we've twice mentioned shoes. So if you would explain how do shoes factor into all of this? Because on one hand, we have the witch bottle here, which, once explained, has all of these, obvious occult and supernatural aspects to it. But shoes, we take for granted. Any number of us just have shoes probably piled towards the front of our house, and we don't attach any kind of special importance to them.
That's right. And that's because we have an amazing factory production system that makes them cheap and easy to buy. Mm. But once upon a time, they were artisan made things. And of course, we do actually still have a culture of the professional artisan shoemaker. It still exists. And there are still people who care about the history of shoes and still make very expensive handmade shoes. But of course, once upon a time, that was the only kind of shoe you could get, would be a handmade shoe. And they were quite expensive. And so they were repaired and repaired and repaired until you eventually couldn't use them anymore, basically. So they were quite valuable in more ways than you can imagine now. But they are probably the most common object that's found in buildings is concealed shoes. They're usually concealed on their own. It's usually just one shoe. In the old days, shoes weren't made to fit a left foot and a right foot. They were just the same, and they would take the shape of the wearer's feet gradually over time. But these ones that we find, they're almost always an odd shoe. I think there's slightly less than 10% are found as pairs, and they're almost always extremely well worn, because who would get rid of a brand new shoe with them being so expensive, like I said before? And also, they then wouldn't be able to, if they hadn't taken the shape of the wearer's foot, they couldn't perform the function which I suggest that they have, which is, and not just me, other people too, but that they act as a kind of decoy, a bit like we were talking about with the witch bottle, that it's got some hair and some urine in it, so it kind of fools any evil energies that are looking for you into thinking that you're there. It's the same idea with shoes, that an evil entity or a spell or something negative trying to get into your house is seeking you to cause you harm, and it finds your shoe, which might have been on your foot for many years and has taken it's uniquely your shoe, it wouldn't fit anyone else. Coincidentally, this is also where the Cinderella myth comes from, the fact that shoes mm-hmm. become a unique thing to someone's foot. So it then plunges down to attack the shoe as a decoy, and it attacks it instead of you. So it's essentially acting as a kind of lightning conductor. It's drawing negative energy away from you, which is great, isn't it? And the idea that it's kind of trapping the energy inside it. Now, the idea that the shoe can act as a trap is weird, okay? But there is some kind of historical evidence for it. So there was a 14th century priest from England, from a little village called North Marston in Buckinghamshire. And he was, when I say he was an unofficial saint, I mean he was never ever canonized by the Catholic Church. So people regarded him as a saint, even though he wasn't actually one. And he is reputed to have cast the devil into a boot, which is a remarkable thing to do, as I'm sure you can imagine. But the interesting thing about John Shaun is that even though he wasn't officially a saint, pilgrimages to his shrine for a period of about 250 years was the second most popular shrine in Britain, and second only to Thomas a Becket at Canterbury Cathedral. In fact, he was so popular that the monarchy in Britain stole his relics from the church at North Marston and moved them to Windsor so that they could benefit from the money that the pilgrims brought to come and visit his shrine. And then those remains and relics have then been returned to North Marston when his popularity waned. But the interesting thing is that the little pilgrim badges that people would pick up when they went to visit his shrine, all of them show him holding a big boot with a little devil poking out of the top. And we're talking hundreds of thousands of people, maybe even millions of people, would have had a badge that showed a devil trapped in a boot. Yeah, and not just that, but an awful lot of churches had imagery, obviously, to do with all of the saints. He was an incredibly popular saint, and so many, many churches would have had an image of John Shaun holding a boot with a devil trapped in it. So from the 14th century onwards, this was a really popular idea that you could trap a devil in a boot. And funnily enough, that some of our earliest examples come from that time. So back to the shoes themselves. As I say, sometimes you find them singly, sometimes you find them in large groups. Sometimes you'll find there'll be a void in a house just through some sort of quirk of construction that people can drop a shoe down. And for example, the plough at Sittingbourne in Kent, there was over 100 shoes, I believe, collected from that building from four different deposition points. And those shoes had been dropped into those voids over generations. So subsequent owners of the building all carried on the same practice of putting old worn shoes down the same holes. And you end up with this record of footwear over the ages, as well as evidence of people's desire to draw evil away from the people in the house.
Now, what about dried cats? Why dried cats?
Oh, the poor little cats. I love cats, so I would never do this to a cat, and I would never advocate anyone ever does this to a cat. This is a tradition from the past. We don't do it these days, so please don't go hiding cats in your houses, people. But yeah, it's really, really common throughout the whole of Europe and Britain and Australia, actually, and the USA. So we have examples from all over. There's also an example that I have on record from Canada, but I don't have so many records from Canada. I've also got a record from Chile, actually. So it's a very, very widespread. And it seems to be, earlier on I mentioned about people being very concerned with who was or how was the house being protected while they slept. And so there's an element of this going on with cats because they're semi-nocturnal. They are quite mysterious in their behaviour. Certainly in the British Isles, there was a belief about the witch's familiar that was often focused on cats as well. So it's that kind of leans towards how mysteriously people thought about them. But yeah, essentially they're benevolent little creatures that are in our lives. They help control pests. But also, we must also consider the fact that they breed like wildfire if they're not neutered and spayed as we do in the modern world. So basically there were too many cats and they were semi-nocturnal, generally helpful. And so people started to, they fell naturally into a helpful role, essentially. So a lot of these practices, one of the things you'll find in common with them is that people were thinking about how do we affect something that's happening on the supernatural plane, as it were. Okay. So most people weren't able to be supernatural. They weren't witches or wizards. Yeah. But there were these things happening to them that were coming from the supernatural plane, or what they believed were happening to them from the supernatural plane. And so they had to find ways of affecting it. Yep. And they had to find special little recipes and special little practices that would have an impact on those things. So, for example, these old shoes that are no longer worth using, no longer worth keeping on your foot, are essentially dead shoes. So they've died. They've flipped over to the other side. So they're now effective against the other side, against the supernatural realm, if you like. And then with the witch bottles, you know, you've got a big lock of hair removed from your hair, or nail pairings clipped off. These are parts of you that were attached to you and were considered to be alive, which are now dead. So they're now on the other side, acting as a kind of lure or bait on the other side. And then the same thing with these nails. And then we come to the point where, in that way of thinking, here is a cat that's alive, but friendly and can control pests. If we make it dead, if we flip it into the other side, we can hope that it continues that role on that side, yeah, as a presence in the house. And so what I think is going on is that these cats are being essentially kind of sacrificed, if you like, to the house, to act as little protectors of the house while you sleep, because they're awake while you're asleep. And they're catching vermin. They're looking out for things that might come in that might harm you. Like, you know, instead of pests, you know, exchange the word pests for spells. You know, negative energy is coming in, you know, and I think that's what people were doing. And there's also, there's a little bit of, I think that the idea that I've just expressed to you is probably the main one, but people have often thought about whether cats were killed as a foundation sacrifice, that you give a life to the house so that it won't then take a life later by falling down on you. And I once had a very brief discussion with Terry Pratchett about dried cats, and that was his idea, was that he thought that was what was going on. But I think it's more to do with this, you know, the role of a cat in death. I think it's more to do with what I said to you earlier about how, you know, you take some of the qualities of the cat, and by essentially killing it but keeping it within the house, you've hopefully got a helper within your house who's going to even... Why would it want to help you if you've just taken its life, right? But I think that was thinking that was going on there. And we find them in all sorts of places. Find them... Like, the first one I ever came across was actually in a village I used to live in, which is weird because I'd moved away. And then the first report that came through my website was of just a few streets away from where I used to live. And a dried cat was found sandwiched in between some layers of thatch in a house. It was basically a 16th century cottage, but they think that the cat dates from 100 years later. Yeah, and it was squashed quite flat, you know, the way, you know, quite serious pressure had been put on it. There's no way it could have got there by itself. It had been placed there quite deliberately. And but yeah, we find others that are sometimes strapped to floor joists, you know, they literally could not have got there by accident. And there are others that are found... Not me personally, but there was another one found sandwiched between tiles and plaster in the roof of a church. Clearly had been placed there by the builders. You know, and that's another thing worth thinking about. Some of these methods and practices were put there by the builders, and some were put there by the homeowners. So we sometimes, you know, when we're looking at an old house and looking at all the finds we get from an old house, we try to discern, you know, which of them were put there by the builders and which were added later.
So was there generally an idea that the builders were sort of on the side of the house and on the side of the occupants? Because I'm reminded of something I was reading about in Chinese traditions. I believe this was from a book by Philip A. Kuhn about the Chinese sorcery scare of 1768. And in this one, a lot of it had to do with written magical protections that were used during a home's construction to protect against potential curses leveled by the actual laborers against, like, the owners or future occupants of a house.
That's an interesting one. You can send me that reference later. I'd like to read that one. But yeah, I think that generally speaking, in England for sure, because that's where I tend to know the most about it. But in England, it seems like it was an additional service that the builders could provide or could offer. Okay. So say you've got two builders and you're trying to assess which one do you want to pay to give them the contract to build your house. You know, one of them has clear expertise in marking the timbers in such a way that it will act as that it will repel evil just through the timbers that have been put up there, you know. Mm-hmm. And so you're going to go with the builders that can help protect you in a supernatural way slightly more than you would another company that wasn't so good at doing that. So it's another service that some builders offered. But it's a bit more nuanced than that, because I think that, you know, you might have... somebody who is the principal builder might employ a carpenter and a stonemason, and they might both have individual practices that they could do. And whether they would do them on that project or not might depend on whether they liked you or not, or, you know, how skilled they were in that field. So there's quite a few different you know, elements at play here. I wouldn't say it's necessarily as simple as one builder would give you the all-round service. You know, they'd give you their cat, the marks, the, you know, all this kind of stuff. And I think some of these practices were a direct response to people feeling that they'd been bewitched as well. So that would have definitely come after a building had been put up. But there were certain things that, certain marks in particular. And, you know, I do think that builders leave shoes, for example, and sometimes they include glass bottles, sometimes empty ones, in buildings as well, as part of, you know, in addition to some of the other masons' kind of traditions, like the topping out ceremonies and things like that. But in terms of specific counter witchcraft, there was quite a few things builders and their tradespeople could do.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
A new season of Bridgerton is here. And with it, a new season of Bridgerton, the official podcast. I'm your host, Gabrielle Collins. And this season, we are bringing fans even deeper into the ton. Colin Bridgerton has returned from his travels abroad. Is betrothal written in the stars for the eligible bachelor? Meanwhile, the ton is reverberating with speculation of who holds Lady Whistledown's pen. We're discussing it all. I sit down with Nicola Coughlan, Luke Newton, Shonda Rhimes, and more to offer an exclusive peek behind the scenes of each episode of the new season. Watch season 3 of the Shondaland series on Netflix. Then, fall in love all over again by listening to Bridgerton, the official podcast, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Subscribe to catch a new episode every Thursday.
Hey, girlfriends, it's me, Carol Fisher. I'm so excited to tell you about the brand new series of The Girlfriends. In season 1, we told you about the murder of Gail Katz at the hands of my ex-boyfriend, Bob. At one point, a woman's torso washed up on Staten Island and was misidentified as Gail. She spent 9 years in Gail's grave, and then she just disappeared.
It's almost like it's become this moral obligation to find her.
And that's what we're going to do. Find this missing girlfriend and tell her story. With the help of some of your favorite girlfriends from season 1, like my producer, Anna.
Oh my God.
My friend, Dr. Mindy Shapiro.
Hi, it's Dr. Shapiro, and I'd like to speak with the deputy medical examiner.
And of course, Gail's sister, Elaine Katz.
Having no closure, it kills you.
Join us as we try to solve a 35-year-old cold case. It's not going to be easy, but it's going to be one hell of a ride.
What?
I can't believe this.
Listen to season 2 of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Now, if this is too big of a question, we can skip this one. But I was also fascinated by the whole topic of horse skulls being included in foundations and in floors. Because on one hand, it makes sense that it would line up with some of the things we've already talked about here, like the horse is an important animal and having an important role in the humans that are doing this. But then there's this whole potential acoustic angle, right?
Yeah, I've been grappling with the whole notion of horse skulls and the different theories at play for quite some time. I don't think I haven't quite finished thinking about it all yet, but I think I've got more answers than I had before. So when we were talking about cats earlier being nocturnal, mm-hmm. and people worried about who was looking after their house when they were asleep, I think that horses play a role in that. And it took me a while to realise this, but basically horses can, although they don't always choose to, they can sleep standing up and with their eyes open. So they can be in a sleep state, but look like they're awake, you know, and they are basically in a shallow sleep. They're ready for action, ready to be alert for the benefit of the other horses that they are with, who might just be literally falling asleep on their back with their hooves in the air. You know, some of them are like that, but there'll be one or two of them that can be awake in this kind of light sleep with their eyes open. And I think that people knew that. So this idea of horses as incredibly vigilant creatures was, I think, part of what's going on. And then we also have the fact that if you take a horse's head and you deflesh it, to use a horrible word, a defleshed horse skull is a really dramatic looking thing. I presume there's a big tradition of using horses in the States, obviously. I presume you've seen a horse skull. You know, they are... They're quite impressive looking beasts. And I think that when they're in that state, you know, when it's just a horse skull, they seem to have almost a supernatural power about them. You know, they take on a different persona. It's not like, you know, a dead cat is a dead cat, you know, whereas a horse skull, as opposed to a living horse, is a kind of supernatural thing. It looks different and it's regarded differently, I think, as well. And, some of the ideas at play in counter witchcraft are about basically being scarier than something else. So, you know, so if you've got something that's really scary, a lesser scary thing might be scared away by it, you know? Like there's one tradition, for example, with rug working that I've heard about, where certain rugs that were put in front of the fire would often have a red diamond pattern on them. Also, like just a red diamond in the middle or in the corners or something. And some of the folklore around this is that a devil poking his head down the chimney would poke his head down the chimney and think, oh my goodness, there's already a devil in the house. I won't go interfering with this, and would go scarpering up the other way to go and find a house that doesn't have a devil in it, because the diamond is meant to represent this devil's eye. And I think in a way, this idea with the horse skull is that they are particularly frightening and quite large, so they could actually intimidate and frighten away other things. And I think that the sort of proof of that is that horse skulls are used in some of these folk dance traditions, which appear to be about scaring away spirits, like the Mary Luid and other, you know, the certain other ones that, like the Obios and what's the other one called? The Hood and Horse as well. You know, these kind of dances and rituals that have these kind of horse-like figures that go dancing around and cavorting around the countryside. And, you know, with the Mary Luid, for example, there's also a custom in that of sweeping the hearth and cleaning the hearth away with this figure that's a horse skull and a big cape. And that, again, seems to sort of tune in with this idea of protecting the hearth as well. So, yeah, I think that the horse skulls, you know, and on top of that, there's all this ancient myth about horses as well, you know, and the idea that horses were thought to literally tow the sun up, you know, mm-hmm. you know, at sunrise, and chariots of the gods almost, you know, and they're also the way that people access the underworld sometimes as well. They, you know, you would ride your horse to Valhalla, or it would take you to the underworld. There's all these really old ideas about horses as supernatural beings that had access to other worlds almost. Yeah, at the same time, they've got this really sort of multifunctional role, almost on a mythic level in human life, you know. And but ultimately, when we're talking about this period of the witch trials, if we want to look at that period, for example, mm-hmm. we're talking about animals that are broadly benevolent to humans. You know, we don't see them simply as eating animals, you know, although they were eaten and still are in some countries. But yeah, they were, you know, kind of a benevolent role in our lives, but also this kind of incredible vigilance about them. And also this kind of fearsome aspect to them when they are in the shape of a horse skull. And in my book, I do cite one example from, I think it's 1897, where this is actually reported in a really good book about folklore in Cambridgeshire, where this building company were essentially laying the foundations for a new chapel in Cambridgeshire. and they sent the builder's lad off to get a horse's head from the knacker's yard, because they had a very strong tradition of placing a horse's head in the base of the foundations, which at first you think this is a foundation sacrifice, but it's not that simple, because after they've poured some beer over it and they've all shoveled various bits of stonework and everything and earth over the top of it, they then said that they were doing this quite clearly to ward off evil and witchcraft, you know. So it's not as simple as thinking foundation sacrifice, appeasing local spirits. They very clearly believed this was for warding off evil and witchcraft, this idea of including a horse's head in the base of a foundation trench, in 1897, which, you know, is well into the industrial era. And we know that there are many examples of horse skulls and horse bones found underneath nonconformist chapels throughout all of Wales and probably much of England as well. And many of these chapels were built well into the 1940s, you know. And yet we also know that horse skulls were concealed under dwellings in the 15th century, because we've got archaeological records of them. Yeah, and that's the whole idea of horse skulls being concealed instead of the whole horse. So I'm not sure exactly when that happened, you know, because the Vikings used to conceal whole horses, or not conceal them, but bury them and have lots of rituals to do with them. But at some point between that period and the 15th century, it became much more about the horse's head or the horse's skull. But we're not sure exactly when.
That's fascinating.
And confusing. Sorry.
No. Is there also an idea that there might have been an acoustic benefit in some of these cases to having the horse skull under there?
I'm glad you brought me back to that, because I clearly wandered away from that topic. But yeah, so there is this idea that somehow horses act as natural amplifiers or acoustic enhancers in buildings. So when people first started looking at the practice of concealed horse skulls, particularly in Ireland, actually, a paper by Sean O'Sullivan, I think it was in 1945, but the reference is in my book if I got that wrong. But yeah, he was asking, you know, what was the reason for them concealing these horse skulls underneath stones in front of the hearth in many of these cottages? And the answer he got from many of these people was that it made the dancing sound better in the evening. You know, so when they were gathered together in the evening around the fire and they were doing some Irish dancing, it sounded nicer by having a horse skull underneath the stone. And then similarly in England, when they found 24 horse skulls beneath the floor of the Portway Inn in Herefordshire, which is in Staunton-on-Wye, this village, they said it made the fiddle go better, made the fiddle sound better. And then in Sweden, for example, when Albert Sandcliff was researching horse skulls beneath barns, threshing barns in Sweden, you know, he came to the conclusion, mostly through what people told him, that it made the flails sound better when they were threshing wheat. Mm. But you know, I struggle with it a little bit, because, you know, when I'm not doing this kind of research, I am also a musician. I've been playing guitar for over 30 years. I think I'm quite good at it, actually. But yeah, I have a horse skull on top of the bookshelf behind my head right now. And I also play guitar in this room quite a lot, and I have certainly not noticed any kind of ringing or pleasant harmonious sound because of it. It may be that I need to attach the horse skull to a floorboard with a big screw in order to notice any benefit. I haven't yet tested that. Let's just say that I'm dubious about the acoustic benefits of horse skulls, especially because I'd say about 50% of the examples I am aware of are in locations where a lot of the sound that they could produce is absorbed by the earth that they're set in, or they're in a part of the building that sound wouldn't reach that part of the building, you know? So I'm a little bit dubious about that. And I think that a lot of the reasons why people gave this explanation is because it was a way of saying that you weren't doing something heretical or superstitious, you know? If you said you're walking down the street with a pair of horse skulls under each arm and the local vicar comes up to you and says, "What on earth are you doing?" You thought, it's to improve the acoustics when we're dancing in the evening. Of course it is, you know. And I would say that probably a big clay bowl or something would be better at it. I mean, maybe it's more expensive. Obviously, we used to have, you know, our transport culture was completely dominated by the horse for centuries. So there was an awful lot of available horse skulls. You know, maybe this was a use people found for them, and maybe people really believed that there was, maybe there is some marginal acoustic benefit that I'm not aware of. But yeah, I personally think that that explanation began as an excuse for why someone is walking around with a horse skull trying to dig a hole into their house, rather than because they thought, I desperately need to improve the acoustics in my house and a horse skull must be the way I do that.
Now, as we mentioned already, these artifacts tend to emerge during cases of demolition or renovation, digging up the ground beneath old dwellings and old buildings, et cetera. And you also mentioned like the black market and so forth. What is the appropriate course of action that you would recommend if anyone out there is engaged in construction, renovation, demolition, et cetera, if they find something that could conceivably be part of one of these traditions? What should they do?
The perfect thing to do is, first of all, as soon as you see something emerge from the ground or emerge from a wall, is just pause and take loads of photographs from every angle. Just sort of really, really record it as well as you can. Maybe do a bit of video as well, you know. Write down when you found it, what you found, yeah, before you even touch it, you know. And then ideally then contact someone who is interested in it or is an expert in that field. Obviously, I would like you to consider me if you find those things, you know, and I'd like to give you some advice or maybe look at some photos and have some input about what you found. And then the ideal thing, because obviously I live a long way away from many of your listeners, you know, the ideal thing is that you find some way of keeping it in the house after you've recorded it as well as you can. Keep it in the house and keep it where you found it, if you can. Some people find solutions like they'll put a little window so you can still see it and appreciate it, and it's a kind of fun talking point in the house. Mm-hmm. I know lots of houses where they've done that with dried cats as well, actually. Even though they're a bit gruesome to look at, lots of people still like to keep them. Obviously, something like a dried cat, it's organic and it could rot if it becomes damp. So you've got to think more carefully about what you do with that. And a lot of people do end up disposing of them for that reason. But, you know, if you can keep it dry and keep it visible, or just conceal it again, just put it back in and forget all about it. Like the first one I ever came across went straight back in the thatch after I'd recorded it. And it's still there as far as I know. So that is the best thing to do. That's by far the best thing to do. Wherever you live, that's the best thing to do. The shoes, by and large, they're not going to be worth anything. So, you know, record them and put them back. You're not going to lose any money. You're not denying yourself some kind of riches by reconcealing a shoe or a cat. You know, the ones that people assign more monetary value to are the witch bottles, because pottery, you know, nice old pottery with clear witchcraft, you know, connections is very interesting. But what I would say to you is sell it to your local museum. You know, your local museum will love to own it, and I'm sure would make you an offer if you have a history, you know, local history museum. And just make sure you offer it to local historians or archaeologists after you've recorded it, and let them buy it off you. Don't just put it on the black market, because someone will buy it and its provenance will be lost and no one will know where it is forever after. So that's my only request, is just record it as well as you can, share that information. And if you're going to sell anything, sell it responsibly. Sell it to someone who's going to care about that object and care about its relevance and its context in your local historical environment.
Now, in some cases, I think you mentioned in the book, the individuals who find these objects then kind of maybe buy into the supernatural ideas around them, even as modern, you know, as residents of the modern world.
Yeah, in modern parlance, you could say that people kind of freak out a bit when they find these things in their houses. So in England, most of the houses where these objects like this are found are usually very historic houses, usually quite desirable, usually quite expensive houses. So in modern times, usually the people that live in these houses are quite wealthy or professional, you know, and usually consider themselves to be quite serious professional individuals. So we've got kind of quite a lot of lawyers, you know, academicians, you know, people like that. And these are people who often don't think they're superstitious or have any supernatural beliefs at all. And yet when they find these objects in their houses, they want to know what they are, first of all, and they'll contact someone like me, and they start to learn more about it, not just from me, but from, you know, other literature online or from friends or whatever. And then they start to get really, 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 really worried that they're disturbing some form of protection. and that whatever evil that these things were protecting against might come back into their houses. And they're often really frightened of, for example, a shoe being taken away from the house, or a cat being moved, or a bottle being broken, or something like that. They feel that some dark energy that was being held at bay by this thing might suddenly reemerge. Now, obviously, when you look at the way people used to use these things, it was usually in a specific response to them feeling bewitched. So the chances of that same cause of harmful energy, the same witch still being alive and transferring that harmful energy onto you, is almost zero. But people, for some reason, feel that this is going to happen to them, and they get incredibly worried. I remember one house where a witch bottle was found. We persuaded the guy to let us analyse the witch bottle, so we were going to take it to university, have it x-rayed and have all the contents analysed. And it took a lot of persuading to get him to do it. And this was for an English TV programme on BBC Two called History Detectives. Mm-hmm. He'd reported the find because he found it really interesting. And as part of the research, you know, myself and my colleague, Dr. Alan Massey, we often would investigate bottles like this. And the production team and us, we had to work on him for ages to allow us to take it away. The whole time it was away, he was ringing every day. Is the bottle okay? When's it coming back? When's it coming back? I need it back in the house. Really, really felt desperately worried about it. And when it did come back to the house eventually after the analysis, he wanted it to be reinterred, and he wanted me to do it because I was the first person he reported it to. And so I agreed. But when I got there, what I didn't know was that he and the production team had employed a group of nuns to pray around me while I was lowering it into the hole. So that was a startling end to that little bit of TV work. But yeah, it just shows how strongly this guy felt about it. He really wanted the thing to go back where it had come from. And he felt that it needed some kind of religious blessing in the process as well to make it safe.
It's fascinating. It really makes me think about, you know, in early on in the book, you mentioned like the different sense world of being in a house in historic times. You know, everything's quieter, and I guess maybe you hear all the sounds or potential sounds a bit more. But then also just thinking about our modern relationship with like the spaces between our walls or the spaces underneath the floor. There are things we know, like we tend to know or assume there are not spirits or demons under there, but we don't know for sure that there's not a mouse. We know there are wires and pipes under and through our house, and we have at least some level of understanding of how those things work, but then also maybe some empty spots in our understanding concerning, say, electrical wiring.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I mean, I would say that that people in the past often used to feel a bit like our children do now, you know? So, you know, you've got a child going to sleep that fears there's something under the bed or something, you know, hiding in behind a cupboard or something like that, you know? I think that it's not quite the same. I'm not saying that people had beliefs that were just like children, but if you imagine a more mature version of those beliefs, you know, that there still is a belief in magic. There still is a belief that there are some entities and some things around you that can harm you, but you can't see them. And you haven't got the power to do anything about them unless you learn some of these practices, you know. Only witches can maybe do something about these things, or white witches, you know, the village cunning person, for example, who's got control over some supernatural powers could maybe manipulate some of these things, but you can't. But all these things are around you. And so I think that some of those fears that you might remember from being a child basically carry over into adulthood as a legitimate belief that everybody shared, you know. Mm-hmm. I really do think that even as recently as the early 20th century in some rural areas, beliefs like this were absolutely normal, and people had very sophisticated responses to them, including the practices I've mentioned, plus others.
Now, this is not an example that I think has any supernatural aspects to it, but I was wondering, I'm not sure if this is a feature of homes in the UK or not, or if this is just a thing in the States, or if this is found throughout the world, but you look at older medicine cabinets sometimes, and there'll be a slot in the back to dispose razors down, like shaving razors. I couldn't help but think of that now and again whilst reading the book as being, like, you know, a place where we we put things that maybe have some sort of connection to our physical body. And they also reminded me of the bent nails a bit, the bent pins, as being these these bits of iron or metal that are no longer useful.
Yeah, I've seen lots of examples of those. I can't remember the name of the Facebook group, but there's a group about things found hidden in walls and everything.
Oh yeah.
And a lot of the examples from the States are where people have bought a really old house and there's been a medicine cabinet, and they found this great big mass of razor blades all behind the plasterboard. You know, mm-hmm. they've all been pushed through this slot and just been allowed to just sit there and rust away behind the wall. And yeah, it's very similar, isn't it? You know, you can see why it's a similar idea, isn't it? You've got this thing, like you say, closely associated with the body. It's then been disposed of behind the wall. It's very sharp. You know, it's this sharp thing where supernatural, is not going to lurk there anymore, is it? Because you've got all these dead, mm-hmm. sharp things. And it's very reminiscent of the belief in knife blades and things that used to be found underneath windowsills and sometimes under door lintels, where there's a, you know, we've talked a lot about this idea that things can be sort of killed in order to be activated on the supernatural plane. And the same would apply to all your kitchen utensils. You know, if you've got a broken knife, it now is activated, if you like, mm-hmm. and it is now a useful form of supernatural defense if you were to secrete it beneath a windowsill or pop it above a door lintel. And so it's very similar. There's definitely a resonance there, isn't there?
Yeah. Finally, as both a witchcraft archaeologist and a musician, do you think there's a shortage of witch bottle mentions in songs about witchcraft and wizardry? Or are there some great examples out there that I just don't know about?
Are you also a musician? Are you going to rectify this situation?
No, I have no ability to rectify it if there is a lacking.
I don't know of any. I'm sure that there are some little folk poems that reference the idea of protecting against witchcraft, but I'm not aware of a good song, especially a rock song, which is my world, mm-hmm. about witch bottles. But I do know there is a metal band called Coast or Ghost, but with a K in the front instead of a G. And I know that they've started writing some crazy songs about counter witchcraft. So there may be a witch bottle song coming from them soon.
Excellent. Well, before we close out here, I imagine that we have perked a number of listeners' curiosities about this whole topic. Can you tell our listeners how they can follow you, the websites or social media accounts they can go to learn more about this study?
Sure. So on Twitter and Instagram, I'm there as Folk Magic Man, as one word. But on Facebook and on my website, it's a little bit more difficult to convey without seeing it, but the domain is Apotropios, which is, you can probably share a link, can't you, in your podcast?
Yes.
But yeah,
mm-hmm.
Aperture, that's probably the best way to do it, but it's apotropios.co.uk or .com, and the same thing on Facebook, it would be / Apotropios. But yeah, that's where it all is.
Excellent. Well, thanks for taking time out of your day to chat with me here. This has been, I've enjoyed it tremendously, and I am sure that our listeners are going to enjoy it as well.
I've enjoyed it very much too.
Thanks again to Brian for coming on the show to chat. Again, the book is Magical House Protection, The Archaeology of Counter Witchcraft, and it's available in physical and digital forms wherever you get your books. We only had time to discuss really a fraction of what is explored in the book, so if this topic fascinates you as it does me, pick it up. Thanks as always to Seth Nicholas Johnson for producing the show, and if you want to reach out, simply email us at contact@stufftoblowyourmind.com.
Stuff to Blow Your Mind is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Managing your diabetes just got easier. The powerful new Dexcom G7 lets you see your glucose numbers on your compatible watch and phone without fingersticks. And because Dexcom G7 is the most accurate CGM system, you can be confident in your food, exercise, and medication decisions. And all those decisions can lead to big results, like more time in range and lower A1C. Get started at Dexcom.com.
Dexcom data on file 2023. If your glucose alerts and readings from the G7 do not match symptoms or expectations, use a blood glucose meter to make diabetes treatment decisions. For a list of compatible devices, visit Dexcom.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan. For data management practices and additional terms, visit visible.com.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.